Craig Burnick's passion for racing is unquestioned. Not only is he the president and COO of Glen Hill Farm in Ocala, he is a member of the Breeders' Cup Board, a member of the Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance Board, an advocate for the horse player, and someone who has never been afraid to stir the pot. Burnick is this week's guest on the Thoroughbred Daily News podcast, brought to you by TaylorMade.
Attention sellers, now's the time to start preparing for the upcoming yearling sales, and putting your yearlings on the path to success begins right now. As the worldwide leader in thoroughbred sales and marketing, the expert team at TaylorMade knows what it takes to succeed at public auction. So if you're ready to get top dollar for your yearlings in 2017, visit TaylorMadeFarm.com and discover what we can do for you.
Glen Hill Farm in Ocala, Florida was founded in 1966 by Leonard Lavin. Glen Hill produced more than 80 stakes winners, including 1994 Breeders' Cup Distaff winner One Dreamer. Lavin died earlier this month at age 97, but the farm remains in the capable hands of his grandson, Craig Burnick, who took over in 2008 as the president and COO. This is Bill Finley with this week's Thoroughbred Daily News podcast, and today we'll look back and look ahead with Craig Burnick. Craig, welcome, and first of all, let's talk about your grandfather, and it's not hyperbole to say that he was a great man with all he accomplished both in the business and horse world. So can you put into words the sorrow and loss of his recent passing?
Well, thanks for having me on. It's never, I guess, a shock when somebody 97 dies, but he was such a large presence in my life and the life of our family. He was really big on all of us staying together, and my interest in the horse business and passion for horses and in the industry, definitely comes from him, having grown up in Chicago. Going to Arlington on the weekends and going to Del Mar in the summer with my grandparents, going to the farm, kind of school holidays. There aren't too many kids I grew up with that were, that were also interested in horses. So, that's definitely all due to him.
And Craig, you took over in 2008, but how active was he, in the beginning, at the end, in between? How much did he still have a role in the running of Glen Hill?
I'd say when I was growing up, horse racing was kind of my favorite sport. I graduated college in 2000, had a series of jobs at Alberto Culver, our family's business, and then tried to do some things on my own outside of that business, but always had a huge interest in the horse business and Glen Hill Farm, and kind of was very familiar with our operation. The reason he turned the business over to me in 08 was with the hope that I would learn what I was doing, with him still alive and, still on his dime. Because he knew that I had a huge passion for the business. Our family has a big passion for the farm. It's kind of where we go for holidays and family get-togethers. But I was the only person that really had an interest in the horses. And, he had seen a lot of different horse operations in his lifetime go by the wayside when the founder died, either because of a lack of, with the next generation, a lack of interest, or frankly, a lack of aptitude in how to take over a business. So, I kind of had wanted to do it my whole life. My parents were interested in me having a more normal career, but, to his credit, he turned the business over, to me, and, we worked on it together. Our relationship changed a bit because I was in a hurry to try and do some things, and he was preaching a lot of patience. But I'd say he was very, very involved the first 3 or 4 years. There wasn't anything I didn't get my way on, but I had to push really, really hard for some of the things. And I'd say I was better for it, and way better for having him, as a mentor. He was with it until the end. He had gotten a lot weaker, and probably didn't have the energy to talk about the horses as much as he did when, you know, in his, you know, from kind of 08 till 11 or 12. But we used to have a lot of conversations and go over the horses and who to breed the mares to and what horses to sell, what horses to keep, you know, what kind of yearlings we were looking for and so on. He was pretty involved, so it was great to have him around.
It's One Dreamer headlong into the final furlong. It's Gary Stevens imploring her for one more furlong. Heavenly Prize on the outside, and now Pat Day asking her for her best. It's One Dreamer trying to hold on for another 50 yards. Heavenly Prize, here's the line. One Dreamer wins and scores a huge front-running upset under Gary Stevens.
That was the 1994 Breeders' Cup Distaff that you just heard, won by Glen Hill Farms' One Dreamer. And Craig, obviously your grandfather was proud of that moment. How could he not be? But again, put that into words. What did that mean for the family and the farm to see those colors win such a prestigious race?
Well, that race was a big deal. I mean, that mare, I know she was a huge long shot. And obviously everything's 2020 when you look back, but she was a really good mare. She was from the Midwest. I think Black Tie Affair was the only Midwest horse that had ever won a Breeders' Cup before her. So those horses didn't get a lot of respect. She won the, it was called at the time, like the Louisville Breeders' Cup, Budweiser Breeders' Cup. I think now it's the La Chouin on Oaks or Derby Day. And then she hadn't run on dirt again the whole year. We were kind of pointing for the Beverly D in Chicago. She was fourth in the Beverly D, but she only got beat a length. Gary Stevens actually rode our filly in the Breeders' Cup and in the race in Churchill, but the rest of the early fires rode, and Gary kind of knew how good our mare was, and she was kind of sneaking away in the Beverly D, and he went and put a little pressure on her early. We put Gary's filly away, but then Flawlessly, who's obviously a Hall of Fame mare, and a mare called Hatouf, who was a Wertheimer mare, fantastic horse. They sort of ran her down, but she only got beat a length. She was a top class mare. And you know, we all bet a lot of money. I was 16. And it was definitely the highlight of Glen Hill Farm kind of in my lifetime up to that point. In the early days, there were some really good horses, but that race was a big deal. Alberto Culver sponsored Breeders' Cup kind of from inception. That was, I think, the 10th year of the Breeders' Cup and the year 11th, 10th or 11th. But, you know, we sponsored it for 20 plus years and we happened to sponsor that race. So it was kind of fun to give the trophy to ourselves and the Breeders' Cup, you know, with a homebred horse. My grandfather raced Relaunch, who he's an important influence in pedigrees today. And, you know, the female line went all the way back to one of his first mares. So that was an important race for sure.
Now, you just realized you admitted that you bet underage at 16, but we'll keep that between us and the listeners of the TDN podcast.
The funny story about that was I remember flying home on the plane and my grandmother, she said, "How much did you bet?" And I remembered I bet like $200. So I had $10,000 at 16. And she said, "Now look, you know your mom's going to ask you, so tell her you bet $10 and she'll let you keep it. Just give me the other 9,000 and I'll give it to you Thanksgiving in 3 weeks." So I did. And my mom said, "How much did you bet?" I said, "I just bet $10. She was such a long shot. And, she said, "Okay, you can keep it, but that's too much money for you." And then 3 weeks later I had like basically once the stack of money. It was pretty funny for a 16-year-old.
Well, good for your grandma. She sounds like a neat lady.
Yeah, she was great.
Anyway, so that's a cute story. So anyways, back to your grandfather, Craig. And I unfortunately never met the gentleman, but I've heard him described as headstrong. I don't say that in a negative way. That's just a personality, and sometimes that's a personality trait that serves people well in business. Do you agree with that? And what's your definition of your grandfather when you think of headstrong?
I mean, very, very headstrong. He was tough, but fair. You know, he never backed down from an argument. And I'd say even when he was wrong, he didn't like losing arguments. So sometimes when it was over something important in business, it was best kind of to say okay and go back a few days later and try and get it done with his idea, but get to your result, because he was very, very, very tough. Grew up in the Depression and fought in World War II and was very proud of his roots and proud of everything being an American, and was an entrepreneur, traveling salesperson, and he liked to fight the giants, whether it was in the consumer products business or the horse business. I mean, if he thought he was right, and if he thought he had a good idea, he advocated for it pretty hard. And I thought that most all of his ideas were with the horse business in mind, not necessarily self-serving. And I think that in his time, there was no questioning his passion, and there was no questioning his integrity. But I think people were a little bit worried about his independent mindedness and kind of which way he could go. And I think that's a trait that most people would agree with about my grandfather.
Now, you were only 29 years old when you took over from him to run Glen Hill in 2008. And that's an awfully young age to be saddled with such a responsibility. Looking back, 9 years ago, were you nervous, intimidated, or were you the opposite? Were you confident and feeling that you were ready for this challenge?
Well, I think at the time I felt I was ready and I was confident, but I think kind of nine years later, you realize how little you know. I could do better than the Chicago Bears general manager, but I probably wouldn't if I really learned how difficult football is. I mean, it's the horse business. I was very fortunate to, be born into the family that I was born into and have the opportunities. But I think until you get the bills and you have to sign the checks and pay the bills kind of every month and realize what it takes to run a horse operation and, how long decisions, when you make a decision today, how long it is before you find out if that was a good decision or if whether it works out or not. I mean, I was probably pretty confident when I took over, but I'd say it's amazing how little I knew, today. And I'm sure in 10 years I'll think I was pretty naive when I was 39, but I know I was when I was 29.
We hear from time to time that there might be an expansion of Glen Hill. You're a Florida-based operation. Some talk about opening up a satellite branch in Kentucky. Anything brewing there?
No, I don't think so. We have a farm in Ocala, has been there since 1967. My wife, Lindsay, and I and our two little girls are moving to Lexington full-time, but that's where we're going to live and raise our family. But Glen Hill will continue to operate in Ocala. We're not going to have Florida breads long-term. We're going to have Kentucky breads, but there's no plan to have a farm in Lexington or anything. We'll keep the broodmares in Kentucky because we primarily breed the Kentucky stallions anyway. And then as the foals are weaned, they'll go down to Ocala kind of at the start of the fall. They'll be raised in Florida, broken in Florida, trained there, and when any of them need a rest or need to come back off an injury, they'll lay up at the farm. But we just won't have the breeding operation in Ocala anymore.
Oh, darn this stiff spray. I need a miracle.
Alberto heard you. Out, stiffness. Now I spray upon your hair a fine hairspray that isn't there. A flexible hold a brush can go through. That's the miracle of Vitrol D. Now an Alberto VO5 hairspray.
A flexible hold a brush can go through. Thank goodness he left the VO5 hairspray.
And now another Alberto Culver product. There was a girl with a curl right in the middle of her ponytail. Her ponytail, washed in ordinary shampoo, did what it wanted to do. Her curl, washed in VO5 shampoo, did what she wanted it to. Reason? 5 ingredients in VO5 shampoo. 3 to clean, 2 to make hair behave itself. Make your hair do what you want it to with Alberto VO5 shampoo. 2 new concentrates, too.
Well, what you just heard was something we found in the archives going back to 1960. That was a television commercial for an Alberto Culver product, VO5. And as we mentioned earlier, that's where Leonard Lavin first made his fortune before getting into the horse business. And Craig, you started out with Alberto Culver. Looking back on it now, could you imagine a life spent selling shampoo rather than running a horse operation?
You know, that was a large company. I mean, there were, you know, if you counted Alberto Culver and their Sally beauty stores, there were like 20,000 employees. And Leonard Lavin and Bernice Lavin were the founders, and Howard and Carol Burnick were running it. And my name's Craig Lavin Burnick. So it was an interesting place to be. I tried to kind of be one of the guys, and I think I gained the respect of, you know, my bosses and my coworkers and people, you know, at that company. But at the same time, you know, I worked hard and was probably pretty good at it, but I didn't have the same passion for it as I did for horses. I'd often, you know, close my door when we had a horse racing kind of in the early days. I remember I would go on youbet.com and watch the horses run when I wasn't supposed to be, and kind of people were chuckling that I was doing the wrong thing. But, you know, I'd go to the track on weekends, and when I had time off, I'd go to Del Mar or shoot down and look at horses for a horse sale, and go back to work on Monday, not see the sale, but kind of look at horses at the barn at Keeneland or whatever. So it's always what I wanted to do. No, I guess I couldn't imagine it, but it would have been a great career too, but I enjoy this much more.
Well, there's a lot more facets to Craig Burnick than his role at Glen Hill Farm. Among other subjects we'll touch on coming up is his advocacy for retired thoroughbreds. But first, this message from our sponsor, TaylorMade.
TaylorMade, the worldwide leader in thoroughbred sales and marketing, is your number one source, offering the full spectrum of bloodstock services. With over 4 decades of experience and the industry's top resources, TaylorMade has the power to help you achieve your loftiest goals. Last year, horses consigned by TaylorMade sold for nearly double the general market average. So if you're looking to get the most for your yearlings, make 2017 the year you give TaylorMade a try. Visit TaylorMadeFarm.com and discover what we can do for you.
So, Craig, not only you are a board member with the TAA, you have been outspoken with your beliefs that the industry needs to do more to take care of its retired athletes. So why is this such an important issue to you?
I'm not one of these people that kind of lays awake and worries about horses that we sold that are running in, you know, kind of lesser races, small claiming races. I love horses and have a passion for horses and love being around them. But, you know, I'm in the business and the industry. But I do understand, you know, the public perception of the horse business from people that, you know, don't have friends in the industry or don't go to the racetrack on the weekends or don't watch races. And it's that, you know, we don't take care of our horses, and that it's a, you know, once they're done racing, they're kind of, you know, used goods, and, you know, people think that they go to slaughter. People think they don't get taken care of, so on and so forth. And I think it's very important, as an industry, that first of all, people's ideas are proven to be not true, and, you know, that we take care of these horses when they're finished racing. I've seen what happened to Ringling Brothers Circus. We spent a lot of time in Del Mar, saw what happened at SeaWorld. And I think that, you know, those people are very, very passionate for what they think and what they believe in, whether they have the facts or not. At our old business, Alberto Culver, you know, we had to stop testing on animals, which is the right move with chemicals. But, you know, in the 70s and 80s, that's what happened, and we had to change. And I think the horse business, you know, there's people always out for blood, and there's an appetite to see, you know, things go by the wayside. So I really think from an industry's perspective, it's hugely important that we support aftercare initiatives. And for me, the Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance is the best place to do that. Thinking as a horse owner, I can't tell you how many times we would get a phone call from somebody that said they had one of our old horses and to send money. And we always would, but we never had any way to verify if it was true or not, number one, if it was a good facility or not, number two. And a lot of times we'd get a call a month later from somebody else that claimed to have the same horse. I just never knew if it was true. So the Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance, they accredit all of the rescue facilities around the country. There's a huge, extensive background check that they go through. And once they get this kind of seal of approval that they pass the accreditation, the Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance then goes and funds these organizations through industry support. So I think it's a great service to the industry. And, you know, we don't look at it as charity. We look at it kind of as an obligation because, you know, I'm very worried about outside factors, influences in the horse business, kind of doing exposés or what have you about this. And I think it's a great, answer. I think we've kind of, we don't have enough money to fix the aftercare problem, but we have the aftercare situation, but we have the solution because we have great facilities that the TAA accredits, and, you know, there shouldn't be horses that go by the wayside. So I'm very passionate about that issue.
And Craig, as you mentioned, you and the Glen Hill Farm team have done everything you can financially to take care of your former horses. I know there's been contributions made to the TAA and other horse rescue operations. But as you well know, someone is going to listen to this and they're going to think the following. Well, it's easy for Craig Burnick. He's a rich guy. Not me. I'm losing money in the game and struggling to make ends meet. I can't afford to worry about what happens to these horses. So I'm sure you've heard that before. What's your response to somebody who would come up with that argument?
Yeah, look, I mean, I am a rich person and was, you know, I'm thankful that my grandparents and parents came before me. You know, so I don't ask people for money. And I think people should donate what they can. I would say that the owners of horses that race horses and the gamblers that bet on horses would be the only two, you know, stakeholders in the industry that don't need horse racing to survive. I promise you gamblers will find something else to gamble on, and I promise you horse owners will find something else to spend money on as their hobby. But if we lose our industry, the van drivers and the blacksmiths and the grooms and the jockeys and the trainers and exercise riders, the people that work on farms and the stallion barn and the yearling barn, everybody that does anything that ever touches a horse, if we lose the thoroughbred industry, they are going to feel it a lot. So I know that they can't give the same amount of money that we give, and we give, you know, we give a lot. We give more than I think most people. And I'm not saying other people have to give what we give, but I think everybody needs to try and give a little something because it's hugely important, because this is the biggest issue, in my opinion, that our industry has, is taking care of the horses when they're done racing, because there's a lot more people outside the horse business than inside that they care about what happens to the horses when they're done racing. They don't care who won the Kentucky Derby.
And Craig, as you've mentioned, talked about, the issue is being dealt with. The problem is probably not nearly as bad today as it was maybe 20 years ago when everybody buried their head in the sands. But it's still an ongoing problem. That we do know that horses still go to slaughter. We do know that horses are neglected after their careers end. Fortunately, again, not as many as likely happened 20, 25 years ago. Is there any magic bullet to this? Is there any way to save every horse? And if not, you know, how do we do better than we do now?
Well, I agree. I mean, I think we're getting better. And I wasn't around 20, 25 years ago, but I do know that, you know, people's attitudes have changed. I mean, dogs used to sleep outside. Now they sleep next to the bed or in bed with people. People's view of animals has totally changed. I don't know if there's a silver bullet that could take care of this whole problem. But I think that the inflammation that there are rescue facilities, I think there's like 165 rescue facilities that we have accredited. Like there's 60 organizations, but 165 facilities, and they're spread all over the country, so very close to every racetrack. And as long as these people that own horses or train horses or take care of horses know that when those horses can't race anymore, there's a place for them to go, and there's transportation paid for, and they can be, and the horses are looked after. The ones that can be rehabilitated and go on to other careers, great. The ones that, you know, have too many problems that they can't be, are still looked after. You know, that's to me, you know, close to the best we can do. And we've done that. So now it's a factor of raising as much money as we can, because we know who the best facilities are that take care of horses, and we know that they can take care of more horses with more money. So I actually think that it's not like mission accomplished, problem solved, but it's gone a long way towards that direction. I think now it's about getting the word out, making people understand that, you know, a lot of thoroughbred organizations have some dead weight, and they don't necessarily accomplish what they're supposed to, and they have some kind of internal politics about what they should be doing. But this organization, I mean, they're all about, you know, raising money and giving it to accredited organizations that can take care of horses. They have very low overhead. Almost all the money goes right to the retired horses. And you know, I think it's a great organization. And you know, we haven't solved the problem, but we've done a good job at it.
There's a lot more to come with Craig Burnick. We'll touch upon his new role as a board member of the Breeders' Cup. But first, this message from our friends at TaylorMade.
Why do TaylorMade horses sell for nearly double the market average? A history of success, honesty, and hard work. For over 40 years, buyers and sellers alike have trusted TaylorMade as the industry's top source for high-quality thoroughbreds and friendly service. While sellers get top dollar for their horses, buyers are rewarded for top results on the track. From sale toppers to Grade 1 winners to Breeders' Cup champions, think TaylorMade, the worldwide leader in thoroughbred sales and marketing.
Craig, just this year you were elected to the Breeders' Cup board, and the Breeders' Cup is honestly an unequivocal success. Let's try that again, an unequivocal success. Excuse me, tripping over those words. Then again, new ideas are always welcome. So what are some of the things as a board member you'd like to see happen with the Breeders' Cup, and what are some of the things that you would like to accomplish as you dip your toe into that water as well?
You know, I've been a member of the Breeders' Cup, which is, there's 45 members that get elected by the industry, the nominators of foals and the stallion nominators, for 3 years. And then they have a board of directors election, which the members choose boards of directors for the Breeders' Cup that are kind of on the more, you know, it's more of a strategic board. It's smaller, and they make most of the major decisions regarding the Breeders' Cup. So I was just elected in July. I was unofficially at a meeting after they knew the results of the election, but I actually won't have my first meeting until September. I think it's during the sales. So I'm brand new. At the same time, you know, I'm 39, which isn't very young, but for the horse business, that's like being a baby. So I'm hopeful that, you know, we can build on the success of the Breeders' Cup, but continue to, you know, not only expand the Breeders' Cup, but hopefully help the Breeders' Cup, help the horse business at large, kind of lift the whole thing up as much as we can. Specifically, I have a sales and marketing background at Alberto Culver, and Alberto was a sponsor of Breeders' Cup, so I have a lot of firsthand knowledge of what the sponsor experience is like with Breeders' Cup and with other events. And I'm going to try and help not only get new sponsors, but make sure that they're able to maximize what they're looking for, you know, by being part of Breeders' Cup, so that they can extend their sponsorships with more money and more years and so on and so forth. I'm really passionate about that. I think everyone on the Breeders' Cup board has horse experience, whether they're an owner, whether they came up, you know, through the industry, or whether they came up working on farms and now run farms and represent major owners, you know, on the Breeders' Cup board. But I think everybody needs to use as much of their experience that they have from outside the horse business too, and really speak up and try to help the business. I think I help the Breeders' Cup and how it helped the business in general. So I'm looking forward to being on the board and really looking forward to getting started.
Craig, you're a Midwest guy. I'm an East Coast guy. I'm recording this from a studio, maybe about 30 miles from Belmont Park. And you may not realize how often I hear, and the subject around these parts is, why is the Breeders' Cup abandoned the East Coast, in particular New York? Now, maybe abandoned isn't the right word, because I realize there's a lot of moving parts and a lot of complications. But people around here really want to see a Breeders' Cup back in New York. And also, some may argue at Laurel, which is has come up as well, at least get it back in the East Coast, eastern part of the United States. Do you agree with that? And what are your thoughts about, you know, coming back to this area?
I mean, personally, I think that the Breeders' Cup should come back to the East Coast. It should have geographic balance. We have important racing on the West Coast. We have important racing in the Midwest. We have important racing on the East Coast. I haven't been exactly privy to the conversations about host site for Breeders' Cup. As a member of Breeders' Cup, as a board member, obviously I'll be very into those discussions when we figure out where the host site. As far as I know, sites have to want to host the Breeders' Cup first and foremost. So, and this is what I understand to be true. Santa Anita wants the Breeders' Cup. Keeneland wanted the Breeders' Cup. Once Keeneland got the Breeders' Cup, Churchill decided they wanted the Breeders' Cup again. Del Mar wants the Breeders' Cup. I think that the East Coast tracks, first and foremost, they have to really want to have the Breeders' Cup. And once they do, I'm sure that they will get into the discussion and negotiation. But there hasn't been, I don't think, the same urgency to have the Breeders' Cup on the East Coast from the powers that be that, you know, kind of run and own those racetracks than there might be from a fan interest or an owner interest. I think that's a simple way to answer the question.
Okay. I encourage people listening to this podcast to take a look at Craig Burnick's Twitter feed, and you're going to find some interesting and humorous stuff on there. And Craig, one of the things that jumped off the Twitter page that I recently read was a quote of yours that goes like this. You wrote that in the racing business, you should never argue with an idiot, never smarten up a dummy, and you're nobody until somebody hates you. That's good stuff. Tell us more. What brought that about, and you know, what makes you feel that way?
Well, I think you can pin something to the top of your Twitter feed, and I do it for myself, so that right. If I go on Twitter, I remember that, because I think Twitter is like 90-95% very positive and great for the horse industry. I think it's been great for inflammation. It's been great for access. Me personally, it's been great to build a community. I've made a lot of connections and actually some good friends that I first met through Twitter, and then now we talk and run into each other at races and sales, and it's been very positive. But, you know, at the same time, there are there's a lot of people that, you know, like they like to take, you know, pot shots, and they like to argue behind screen names and so on and so forth. And, you know, I guess it's all part of, you know, you ask for it if you have a Twitter handle and are active on social media. So it's nothing that's not to be expected, but I try not to engage. I like to engage people that are, you know, keep things on a decent level, but people that kind of decide to make it personal or try to be jerks, I try not to talk too much. But that reminds me of it at the top thing on my Twitter profile.
Well, I found it amusing for what that's worth. Craig, another thing you have not been afraid to speak out about is that the takeout rate in this sport is an issue. I've always thought, as a horse player, that's one of the reasons why racing does struggle to find customers, is because our product, frankly, is much more expensive than the competition, casinos, betting on sports, et cetera. So in that vein, you know, what was your reaction when one of the, you know, the iconic racetracks in our country recently announced that they too were going to raise takeout? And of course, you know that I'm talking about Keeneland.
You know, I mean, it's disappointing. There's no question Keeneland wants what's best for horse racing, probably, you know, more than any other organization. They would have horse racing's interest the most at heart. I mean, they're important in the Lexington community. It's a great racetrack. It's a sales company. The better they do, the better purses they can have with their sales company, the more money they can give to charity, you know, the better it is for the community. And obviously they are for horse racing long term. And I don't think you could say the same for every racetrack. But I was very disappointed when they raised the takeout. You know, from a business standpoint, the only way that we can grow a business long term is to try to be competitive for our core customer, which I think, you know, the two customers that matter, we said it 15 minutes ago, are the horse owner and the horse player. And they all have to have better experiences. So this takeout, that cuts right to the pocketbook of the horse player. And when we have less, I guess, dead money in the game from a poker standpoint, a tournament standpoint, when there's less average people coming to the racetrack every weekend and every day that are putting money into the pools, it's more and more regular players. Some are great horse players, some aren't, but they all have a more educated understanding of horse racing than the average player used to 25 years ago. And you keep banging up against better and better players, so the returns get less and less. And then when you raise the takeout, obviously they win less money when they win a bet, and when they win less money, that's less money they're going to put back into the pools. And you know, it doesn't take a genius to know that in a few years that money's gone just through the rake. And I think that the only way that the business is going to be able to survive with a good purse structure is to lower the takeout, try to bring people back to the races. I think the fan participation is important. I think the gambler participation is important. I think it's all important. And I personally would be happy to race for less money as a horse owner if we were taking better care of our gamblers, because I think long-term, that's the way to grow the business, is through people gambling and through fans coming to the racetrack, some of them turning into gamblers. when you raise the takeout, I just think it's very short-sighted, and you know, it's disappointing that the Keeneland did it. Now, they were the best as far as takeout, and they weren't the best. Kentucky Downs are the best, but they're way better than Churchill, and now I understand that they're about at Churchill's levels. It's a great meet. There's full fields. People are going to keep betting, and they maybe can get away with it. But I think when Keeneland sits here as a gold standard, as they have been for a number of years, and they have a lower takeout, and they have a successful meet, I think it can make other racetracks hopefully pay attention and maybe try to emulate Keeneland. But I guess the reverse is true. Keeneland is great for the racing business, but you know, I'd have to disagree with that decision. And you know, I think it's pretty short-sighted. We need to figure out different ways to raise money. And if there's not different ways to raise money, you know, so be it. But I really wouldn't penalize the horse player.
Craig, as we mentioned earlier, your age, 39, in the rest of the world is not middle age, but not young either. So far as somebody who's influential in racing and involved in various boards, you're a babe. So you have a perspective that maybe some of your peers that have been around longer do not have. You're more active in things like social media that have become all the rage. So we've talked about two very important issues that obviously you care about in your advocacy for the game and your desire to see it thrive. One is takeout that we just mentioned, and the other one, of course, was thoroughbred aftercare. What else would you like to add to the list? You know, what are some of the other issues or problems you think that racing really needs to face up to ensure that it continues to thrive and is still around for, you know, the Craig Burnicks of not the next generation, but the generation and generations after that?
Yeah, I mean, it's August, so there's round tables, and there's the new Equestacon conference, and you know, there's a lot of great ideas for the sport, and a lot of people that want what's best for racing. And I'd be one of them, but I think that the frustration that I have from the business, is that it's always an either or discussion. You're for the federal bill or you're against the federal bill. You're for LASIKs or you're against LASIKs. And I think that in our business, the answer needs to be somewhere in the middle. It's not what anybody wants, but I think compromise and trying to move forward so that we can build the game is so important. Like the business doesn't have a structure today that if somebody had a fantastic idea that everybody thought was great, that was going to help the business, there's no way to implement it. We have, every state has their own horse racing board. They have their own horsemen's group. They have their own racetrack. And each state acts like a different entity. So it just makes sense that the states would share best practices. They'd have the same rules. They'd have the same licensing. They'd have the business needs uniform rules. It needs that for simplicity of investment, for more owners to get involved, for horses to ship back and forth. I think that the jailing of claiming horses is another thing that's like, we don't play a lot in the claiming game, but it's so short-sighted. I mean, horse owners need to be able to buy horses and race them where they want to race them, whether it's their home track, whether it's a place that their horse can be more competitive and what have you. And these racetracks, they basically want to put walls up around their track. They want to act like the horses are, you know, a can of peanut butter that they can take off the shelf to put on a sandwich when they want to make that race. And if they don't want to make it, you know, you sit there or you have to run where you don't want to run. And I just think that it's very, very difficult for people to own horses today with this environment of every state having their own rules and so on and so forth. You know, the federal bill, it's not a perfect bill. There's a lot of questions about what if. And I'm, you know, I understand, you know, horsemen's feelings about Lasix and race day medication and, you know, the smaller racetracks and the cheaper horses. And I totally understand those arguments. And at the same time, I understand the other side too, which wants a better sport, more international level playing field, more respect internationally. So, I mean, I totally understand both sides. And I personally think that we're never going to get one or the other. It needs to be somewhere in the middle. And whether that's, you know, a two-tier system with graded stakes running, you know, the way internationally major races are run and the rest of the races staying as they are, I mean, I think that'd be a great compromise. If it's weighted system where Lasix is 5 pounds and Butte is 3 pounds and it's all declared in the racing form, you know, I think that would be a great compromise. But continuing to go on the road where we are without any sort of progress, I think it's beating a lot of people down. And I mean, the business needs to move forward so that we can worry about marketing it to new people, getting new investment, worry about the handle, worry about the takeout. I just don't think that it has enough focus because everybody's so focused on this federal bill. So, I mean, I have a lot of issues and frustrations, but I think the nice thing about Thoroughbred After Care Alliance is that, you know, it's something that everybody agrees on and can work on together, and you can see how much they can do when people get on the same page. So that's kind of, I don't know if I answer your question or not, but that's my rambling answer anyway.
Well, I think you did answer the question, Craig, and I appreciate the answers. I appreciate all your thoughts, and especially appreciate the great memories you gave us of Leonard Lavin, your grandfather and the founder of Glen Hill Farm. We also want to thank, of course, our sponsor, TaylorMade, for making this Thoroughbred Daily News podcast possible. And once again, Craig, thanks so much for your time, and good luck. See you in the winner's circle.
Thank you. Hopefully next time I have a better horse, we can talk about one of the current horses. I can come back on.
Oh, we'd love to have you on again. Thanks so much, Craig.
Appreciate it. Bye.